ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is David Kaplan, Director of Industry Insights at Yext. A New York City-based journalist for over 20 years, David is a former editor and reporter at AdExchanger, GigaOm's paid content, Adweek, and MediaPost. He's also written for Advertising Age, Broadcasting and Cable, Crain's New York Business, The New York Post, New York Newsday, and The Boston Globe, as well as covered financial issues for The Bond Buyer and Worth magazine. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Gabriella, and I really appreciate it. So it's mutual.
You have a pretty extensive career in media reporting. Using that to set the stage, can you tell us the sort of three largest or most important trends that you've noticed in media during your time as a reporter? Just landscape, see changes that you've seen.
Sure. I think the biggest one, having covered advertising and marketing for the better part of 15 years, a little more maybe, just rounding it off, it really is just, you know, how automation has really changed the nature of advertising, the way it's bought, sold, created, and what that kind of means for media companies as well. I was interested in advertising because that was obviously, you know, a major pillar in terms of how publishers, magazines, newspapers, which I'd written for, were supported. So it was kind of like, you know, especially looking back 15 years ago, you were wondering, oh God, with the advent of the internet, where do things go? And then about a decade ago, when programmatic and automation and real-time bidding started changing the way, you know, really changed the way that advertising was bought and sold, even beyond the internet, really impacting TV and radio advertising, out-of-home advertising as well. The idea of what did that mean for the planning and creating process of ads, and especially as ads became more about sort of targeting the right person at the right time, that kind of cliche, you know, as opposed to the more creative and brand affinity associated mass media of that we still associate with television advertising and kind of the Mad Men era.
Right.
Thinking about how that has changed things and how it's almost the idea of automation, I think a lot of ways has, and ad tech has really kind of almost turned the advertising industry inside out, where it's almost doing something that it never really had been situated to do before, which is to just really kind of personalize and customize things and really have struggle with that mass brand affinity idea, and instead rushing to just sort of this immediacy. And that has obviously led to cheaper, lower cost, and not as creative advertising as we kind of associated, as I said, in the past with that Mad Men era. And, you know, thinking about the future of advertising, which again is still, it's still this kind of struggling area, especially for publishers. Just reading about BuzzFeed yesterday and how they're thinking of trying to form an alliance with rival publishers to,
right,
like I think Refinery 29 and others.
I think it's going to be Vox personally, because
yeah,
I think they have the same backers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, the same. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of, they're already kind of close already, but just the idea that you would never think in the past that, say, you know, Time and Newsweek would form some sort of ad network that would benefit them both and that kind of thing. And that all these kind of competing lifestyle, especially in the lifestyle area, if we can kind of consider those entities, you know, that, which is something that attracts a lot of expensive and luxury, you know, based advertising, as opposed to just this click here now and buy it,
right,
that they're struggling sort of, I think, says so much about the media space and advertising space in general. So that's kind of a rambling answer, but
no, well, that's interesting. And it also related with what the technology allows you to do is our own human interaction with that technology. And, you know, the different device manufacturers are upping user controls for push notifications, and people are increasingly aware of privacy and sensitive to marketing messages. And as those things become more top of mind to consumers, what does this mean for brands? You know, it's great if we can target, but what if people say, you know what, I'm getting a little creeped out by the targeting?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something that, you know, the industry has kind of been struggling with for the longest time. And certainly, as you said, kind of device makers on one hand, like Apple, for example, Tim Cook is, you know, again, it's a big statement when he says there will probably need to be some regulation regarding privacy and targeting when it comes to, you know, interactivity and interactive media. One thing for Apple to say, which always, you know, wanted this walled garden and never relied on advertising the way, say, Google or Facebook have, mm-hmm. and how it's obviously easier for them because they want to make sure they sell these devices and that those platforms are kept safe, and that, you know, that's all good for Apple. They can collect, you know, sort of the data, and they can decide what is, you know, publishers' apps on their platform can access. And that's, mm-hmm. they're kind of, you know, they kind of have that level of protection there that Facebook obviously has certainly struggled to keep a hold on, and Google to some extent as well, because again, they are chasing those advertising dollars, and they are certainly more willing to make compromises and also having difficulty trying to catch bad actors when it comes to privacy violations. Right. So I think what it means is, at the same time, consumers who, you know, they want to know what restaurant to go to that's near me when they look at their phone, either, you know, in Google Maps or something else, or asking their friends on Facebook, hey, what restaurant should I go to when I'm in Paris, for example. Mm-hmm. People, you know, want to put all of that out there, let everyone know where they're going, what they're doing, where they are. But at the same time, then they're sort of, wait a minute, why am I getting ads for this? Or, you know, are my devices listening to my conversations and then sending me ads? You know, the idea is consumers need to sort of decide and really take much more control about, do you want your location signal open all the time on every app? And, you know, the idea of it's not really been in the interest of anybody to educate consumers there. And obviously consumers just know what they want in a moment, and they know in another moment what they don't want. So I think it's a really difficult time for media companies. I think, you know, maybe Tim Cook is right that sort of, hey, we don't know how to educate people, so instead we'll just leave it to lawmakers to come up with some sort of blanket, and they'll fight about that next.
Well, except, I mean, it's interesting because with the legislation in Europe, as far as I can tell, all it's meant is that every single site I go on tells me there are cookies. And it's still not clear as a user if I can say, I would like to use the site, but no, you can't track me. I'm so used to having to give over my privacy in exchange for, you know, ease and utility. You know, I guess so. Would regulation, is the current regulation, the European regulation, isn't that you can share data and then request all your data be scrubbed? Or mm-hmm. do you have a little bit more that you can share with people?
Yeah, it is obviously, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of that's what people see, is basically just a little warning. Now every site, you know, when we had geomarketing, we had to do the same thing, even though we did not sell advertising on geomarketing. We still had to just make sure, put that GDPR warning up there that, hey, if you share your email address, say if you're signing up for our newsletter, for example, and we had to make sure we had that warning, or someone could say in anywhere that we're violating that law. And it was very, you know, confusing to publishers and time consuming. And also in the end, what does it really mean? As I said, you're going to look at a site, you're not necessarily, you just want to get where you're going and do what you're doing, see what you want to see. And this little pop-up nuisance is just something you click on kind of automatically. You probably just click the X, or maybe you'll click OK, and then not think about, you know, okay, what advertisers will have information on me, or what can't I see on the site because I'm not sort of sharing my data, or, you know, how does that
impact my experience?
How does that site make money if they can't, you know, they've been relying on that for so long? Maybe they are going to have less content, maybe they'll even go out of business or something. That's not something that people are automatically thinking when they see that we track you with cookies.
Right, right. Well, and it's interesting because messaging is, I think, sort of the next frontier in terms of, if we think about social as being a place where brands could insert themselves into the social life of consumers. Even more insertion into a conversation between consumers, or a messaging like Facebook Messenger, or if they could do it with text messaging. But then if we have this dueling interest in privacy, where do you think, you know, based on your experience looking at how people relate to brands and trends, do you feel that advertising within messaging is going to become the norm? Do you think it's something that people won't go for? How do you think it's going to shake out?
Yeah, I do think that it's practically already there, certainly with when it comes to chatbots, but also with Facebook owning, you know, WhatsApp and obviously with Facebook Messenger and what Google, you know, does with Gmail, for example, it's all there. You know, Apple just now also allows, you know, people to just text and even just send money directly, just pay for something through text messages as well, through iBusiness chat. So I think that is definitely happening, and the way it shakes out is, I think the way a lot of this shakes out. You know, in the past, everyone would, you know, every few months, every time when Facebook was in its kind of, you know, peak days maybe, or at least more friendly days as far as consumers would say, you'd always see every few months when they would do some redesign, people would complain a little bit, then they'd go back to using it normally and posting all their photos or, you know, basically showing what they're buying or that kind of thing. And then, you know, once the kind of Cambridge Analytica scandal happened, then all of a sudden people started pulling back and then started questioning, what am I getting from what Facebook is getting from me?
Did you find, were there studies that proved that people actually were pulling back? And some of the, I monitor engagement with entertainment brands, and so that's a slightly different level of engagement. But we noticed no change in engagement. What we saw was the entertainment brands pulled back on their posting because they were worried about it. But those brands that didn't pull back, the engagement was exactly what they had no hiccups in engagement. So I'm curious if that's a sort of educated, you know, thoughtful journalist like yourself who say, this is what's liable to be going on. Is the Cambridge Analytica scandal, are the current, like the New York Times article about Facebook, does that really impact, you know, Cindy Lou who's posting about her cat?
I don't think it impacts it immediately. I do suspect, and I've seen some other studies that show that people are, you know, maybe posting less, or that some study I think show that people are kind of changing their privacy settings and looking more, searching more for what are my privacy settings on Facebook than they had in the past. So I think, but I still think that Facebook is the way that people still sign on to a lot of websites that they want, and it's still there for them every day. They're still, you know, the numbers are still
huge. Despite that hack, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. Another thing I'm curious about is what this movement means in terms of the digital divide between people who do not have access.
Yeah, well, you know, that has been, you know, sort of a problem all across the board, where you saw tech companies a few years ago trying to, you know, spur more investment in rural areas, for example. Kind of reminded me of the Depression era rural electrification programs that went out from the government. And you haven't seen too much of that. I guess maybe also the current political climate maybe has stymied that. But it's a little bit, just a little bit. You know, trying not to go there too much. But the idea of who's going to solve the problems of, you know, again, from privacy to that digital divide is huge. And no one is, you know, people are talking about it a little bit here and there and acknowledging it, but you don't really see much happening there. And because the idea is, okay, that's a problem to solve. Maybe it's, you know, Bill Gates's problem. Maybe he'll solve it. Or maybe, you know, former Mayor Michael Bloomberg will donate money to do something like that. You know, you don't see anything really comprehensive being promoted.
Right. You don't see the equivalent of the interstate system being created so that everybody can travel on this digital highway, interesting. You don't see that kind of a capital expenditure around that. Related to the privacy question, I'm curious about loyalty programs. Mm-hmm. And do you think that people understand the data exchange? I mean, I know when you mm-hmm. when you sign on to a website, at least you've got to click the box to make it go away and ostensibly right. could read it. But when you sign up just so you can get your coupon or your free turkey if you've spent enough money at the right. grocery store, do you think people are really witting of the exchange?
I don't think so. I don't think people ever really did. I mean, I think like when people would, I remember for years, you know, you'd go to a drugstore and someone would ask me, they'd invariably, they would have someone I feel like with an invisible gun to their head at the counter saying, oh, do you want to fill out this long form so you can get rewards? It's like, no, I just came here for some Advil and I want to get out of here. I don't want to fill out a form and who to save what, 5 cents? Right. But, you know, obviously because apps make it so easy to do it, and people are so used to just being able to, you know, be inside that app to quickly order something. And then if they can, you know, get something more for it, whether it's, you know, Amazon Prime, I think has really influenced the way loyalty programs, you know, have become something much deeper and more intensive. People are, I think, they just see the free stuff. And then when there's news about a data breach, they kind of freak out for a few minutes, but then they kind of go back to normal. They complain about it. I mean, it depends, obviously, how bad a data breach is. And as you said, kind of, you know, about Facebook as well, you know, there may be some sort of negative views about it. But as you said, the people are still there. And obviously, maybe major brands have pulled back, but they've done that before. And we'll always wait and see what the ultimate reaction is once the dust settles over, say, a big news story like, as you said, the New York Times last week with Facebook's PR program that may have been a bit shady, just again, to put that mildly.
What's interesting there is that Facebook has a distinctly sort of, if you will, liberal spin, mm-hmm. but that this effort was to, for fear of conservative blowback. I don't know. It's just sort of an interesting situation there. When you look at loyalty programs, do you see demographic differences?
Yeah, I think that this is something we've talked to a lot of companies about, particularly in the travel space, about, you know, that have been used to sort of doing loyalty and rewards for the same way for the last 50 years. And now the idea for especially millennials who are also getting older, and thank God, I guess, and, you know, are really influencing the way other people use these programs. And the idea of, I just want a cheap discount is not enough anymore. The idea is that there has to be a real sense of, you know, convenience and ease. And again, getting back to that question about sort of, you know, the brand experience or customer experience that people have, the idea of, you know, a rewards program that will promise you to not have to wait in line to check into a hotel and to use your app as a key maybe is, you know, has a lot more appeal than just sort of, okay, hey, save, you know, $20 if you order room service or something.
Right.
Things like that, that's where loyalty is kind of going, sort of like the idea of beyond the discount. What can you do to sort of make this experience faster and more, you know, personalized to me? Oh, I stayed with you before. I shopped with you before. Here's what you like. Here's, you're not going to waste time.
You should know me.
Yeah,
sort of,
exactly.
This is what I'm trading for.
Right.
Right.
And how well do you do that is, you know, it's sort of, as you said, it's kind of like with anything else, the way that someone greets you when you come into a restaurant could either be really creepy if they just start, you know, sort of, oh, here's the chicken already because we know you've ordered that 3 times when you're here. That's, you know, sort of maybe kind of annoying and presumptuous as opposed to saying, well, you like this, you know, open my mind up to other choices. Like, well, you tried the chicken, maybe try something, you know, like this. That's more different as opposed to just, oh, here's what you had before. We know you so well and you came in the same time last time. And so we know exactly what to give you to that kind of level of kind of customization.
Like a Netflix algorithm that if you like the tikka masala,
yes.
you will love.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Amazon Prime and how it's changing things. I mean, what's interesting there is that a lot of purchasing is happening straight on Amazon. I believe a lot of search actually takes place on Amazon and talk about intent to purchase, right? And thereby cutting out the brand in many, many ways. And to your point about advertising, you know, it's very transactional there. You're not going to get super creative with sort of SEO based.
Exactly.
So how do brands in that environment differentiate themselves when it's stripped down to SEO? I mean, we talk all about authenticity and storytelling and emotion and engaging and relationships, but here we are and we're staring down the gun at the Internet of Things. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these searches are taking place on Amazon. It seems sort of schizophrenic. So what can brands do?
Yeah, it's really, Amazon has really become, especially for brick and mortar retailers, has become the new frenemy. It used to be Google, but now it is Amazon. And you think about the experience of searching for something on Amazon. You know, Amazon, you know, I like to think I pay attention to these things, hasn't really improved the way things look to a great extent, as opposed to, say, you know, Google in terms of what you can do with images and how things look there when you search. But Amazon is just strictly, it seems to just give you the bare bones basic image of something, or and product description is obviously, you know, as deep as you want to get, but it's all, you know, it's all not very visual and all not very, you don't like look at Amazon, you know, the way you would look at other sites, like say, you know, the way Pinterest sort of showcases things. You're not looking at Amazon because, oh, this is like so pleasurable just to sort of look at all the stuff. You're looking there to find the exact thing, you know, within the shortest amount of time. And that is, I think, kind of offers the clue to what brands need to do in terms of satisfying that Amazonification, if you can kind of apply
sort of the efficacy, the efficiency, because also what's interesting is despite being stripped down, the impression I get is actually the Amazon purchaser tends to be a little more affluent. Mm-hmm. Is that correct or is that completely?
That is. Yeah, I think that is. I think that's true because, you know, it's the idea of, you know, you could get this anywhere in any time. You're generally not, you know, buying, you know, things that are, you're not buying a car necessarily on Amazon. Maybe people have done that on eBay occasionally. But the idea is that you're just like kind of stocking up on these little things that you really don't want to spend time in a store doing. It's kind of, you know what you want and you just want it delivered to you and taken care of. Whereas other people, you know, don't feel a need to sort of look to that. They, you know, for a lot of people going out to say a Costco, that's the better way to do it. It's you get kind of, you get those discounts, you get to have everything all at once, you're immediate and you're done. Other people who are, you know, who are at their desks a lot of the day.
Who are you talking about?
You know, I don't know. But then like, you know, like, hey, you know, hey, you're doing a podcast interview and then, hey, might as well buy a new pillow for the couch. Why not? Oh, that's kind of simple. Or just hit a dash button on something and then just have that. And so, you know, there is, as you said, that's also part of that digital divide where, you know, you're going to pay, you know, $100 a year for a membership or something. And then, oh, yeah, sure, I'll watch videos as well. And, you know, you'll just get used to that kind of shopping as opposed to getting your car on the way home from work and picking up stuff at the, you know, local market or whatever. I mean, Amazon has kind of surprised me in getting into that food delivery area as well. I don't know how successful they've been, but it'll be interesting
to see for sure.
Yeah, but I've been surprised to hearing how Uber Eats has. I generally rely on, you know, things like, again, this maybe, you know, I don't want to give away, and you know, no one thinks themselves as affluent, but we do a lot of home delivery now from Caviar, which is obviously more high end and more you know, expensive restaurants than just sort of, you know, pizza and Chinese food and tacos. So the idea is that bifurcation of what people are getting, you know, there is room for Amazon and Uber Eats as well as these other high end, you know, areas as well. And it's kind of, especially as this divide, you know, continues to widen, you know, how do companies sort of manage that? Is a kind of,
well, and also another thing is we see voice become the UX increasingly, how that can cut out the brand's voice, you know, from the conversation. If you have Internet of Things and you have voice, and how important do you think voice will take over, or do you think there will always be, you know, that it's sort of flash in the pan, not going to be?
No, I think voice is definitely going to be more important, but I do see that, like, right now we just have kind of mostly it's either Alexa from the Amazon Echo or, you know, Google Assistant on the Google Home or Google Mini. And those are, you know, there's Amazon Show, and Google just came out with its screen version. Mm-hmm. Facebook has something of its own just to have, I think, messaging. So I think the screen, that's, you know, the screens are going away, but they are going to evolve where people will be, you know, talking to their devices and expecting an immediate specific response back. And I think brand, that's another thing that brands will have to worry about. The idea of having a website, for example, has changed a lot by social media, by having an Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, and Twitter presence has changed the nature and importance of a website. I think they'll always be there as placeholders, but if brands are not managing the, yeah, those social media accounts,
yeah, almost are more important to a new brand, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
If you have to pick between setting up your website and setting up your social, I'd say do your social first.
Exactly, because that's where people will find you and also reach out to you. They're not going to want to search for you and then go to your website and then search for how to contact you. They want to go directly to you either on Twitter or Facebook Messenger or something
like
that.
Do you think you even need a website anymore?
I think as a placeholder, but it's just, you know, just as a kind of a table stakes sort of thing, but it's not something that needs that much attention as opposed to, as you said, the social media accounts and now voice, having mm-hmm. a voice presence and developing one to some extent. That's where brands will have to, you know, really think much more creatively and be much more present, because the idea is someone, you know, tweets at your brand, you're not responding within, say, you know, 15 minutes, you're in trouble. And that's
people are so, you know, impatient.
They are. I know. And more, especially as I said, voice will only make it more, because the idea of the expectation there of that immediate response from the device is, you know, the way social has an email trained people to be much, to expect a faster response to a question. It's now, it'll now be down, if you don't have the right answer for someone in a fraction of a second, you know, then your competitor is going to, you know, look a lot better. So,
right.
So as I said, when it comes to voice, you know, the idea, and it comes down to that question that you kind of started with about the nature of how digital has changed the nature of advertising, I think it's, and loyalty, the idea of utility and giving the consumer what they want as opposed to pushing something at them just in a kind of direct response sort of manner or in a general mass media manner is what's going to be most important. Being able to sort of balance the need for, again, for personalization and responsiveness to get the exact answer someone wants, you know, that's something that brands are going to have to work with, even, you know, to a larger extent, even more, to sort of work with Google and Amazon and Facebook and Apple to sort of make sure that they show up.
We've all turned into the Veruca Salt. We all want Oompa Loompas, and we want them now.
Exactly. There's definitely copyright that now. The Oompa Loompa economy is where we're headed.
So IBM Watson is developing AI tools. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a good thing? Do you think that's inevitable? What does it excite you? Does it just like, yeah, that's table stakes? What is your opinion on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it is, let's see, well, it kind of excites me, I guess, the way that, you know, reporting on this stuff does. But I think, you know, personally, I think it's inevitable.
Right.
And it's something, it's so funny that's been talked about for so long. And as you said, it's the question is certainly how do brands, one, maybe, again, balance that creepiness with mm-hmm. utility factor. The idea is that I want you to, you know, you should know, I want you to know me, but I don't want you to know me so well that you're constantly there or that you're constantly feeding me.
That brands should have an ethics department or an ethics officer? Do you think that that's something that we will start seeing?
I think so. To some extent, like something like an ombudsman, you know, I think, like, again, with, you know, sorry to talk so much about Facebook, but I think one of the things that Mark Zuckerberg proposed was having another audit. And I think that's, you know, it's almost where that's becoming a kind of cloak to sort of hide behind for a while, just to say, okay, we've done something wrong, and now we're going to just audit and see what we did wrong, and it doesn't really do much. And I think that's also one of those things that there's no silver bullet. It's kind of some form or another, you're going to have to be able to see, okay, what's the potential blowback if we do this? What's the potential consequences if we, you know, insert ourselves in?
Well, right. You need to have that before you actually build the product, or at least part of the team, I would think that you need to have diverse voices and people saying what, yes, it's a tool, but all tools can be misused. What are the risks? How do we protect against bad actors? You know, and then how does that get baked into how we look at things?
One thing that I really think is something that brands need to focus on. Last fall, there was a major lawsuit, a class action lawsuit involving Kmart and a few other brands over there, and McDonald's, over their websites, that they were not responsive to people with impaired vision. They were charged with violating the Americans with Disabilities Act, that all these companies need to do that. And the idea that those companies faced was, whose job is that? Is that an IT job? Is it a marketing job? And so that's that. Again, that ombudsman role that I think.
Well, and how does that even get determined? How do you make a website vision impaired friendly?
Not for totally blind, but there are people who are legally blind who there should be some. There apparently websites are required to have some adjustments where someone who is vision impaired can have a setting on the website that makes that site a bit easier to navigate for them, and that the idea that it wasn't is, which is kind of amazing. You wouldn't think that, as you said, that people, you know, with that problem would be thinking about, you know, websites, but like everybody else, that's a way.
Sure, of course.
And so having it either with voice prompts, and there's a lot of things apparently that the act kind of calls for and that governs websites, but the idea, but certainly no company felt that they had to have someone monitoring that. And it kind of fell through the cracks. And that's one area, as I said, that, you know, these anticipating, you know, things like that seems impossible, but the idea of, okay, how do...
Well, you know, accessibility.
Exactly. Respond to our website, our voice platform, our, you know, wearable device, all those things will have to kind of, again, it's in that marketing and sort of CTO, chief technology officer role. So there's going to be maybe a hybrid there as well that can also do that kind of, you know, ombudsman, you know, kind of oversight role.
So how can people find out more about you, and are you still writing articles, and how can people keep abreast of some of these things?
Well, so in the, you know, previous role was managing editor of geomarketing, which, you know, was the parent of, and now I've shifted over to a new role called, as you said, director of industry insights. So writing for Yext's blog, I have a few things coming up there. We talked about SEO, have some SEO trends that I'm working on now that will be coming out shortly. So check out the blog and follow me on Twitter, certainly, very easily. Luckily got there early. David A. Kaplan is the handle on Twitter. So
you are lucky.
I know. I was like, there's a lot of David Kaplans out there. So a lot of them took other things. So at least I got Twitter. So
yes. Well, you know, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to have you on, and good luck with everything.
Well, thank you, Gabrielle, and looking forward to having you on our podcast as well. So, and when you're done listening to this, check out CMO on the Go. So,
fantastic.
I got that plug in. So,
Thanks so much. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next. I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, David Kaplan. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again right here on Up Next.